At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Big banks, toxic assets, and Bear Stearns. Back in the news today, it's like the financial crisis never left us, isn't it? Also, energy independence means what exactly? And a chat with Barry Diller from IAC, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve what potential customers find online in search engines and review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at NovoNordisk-US.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Tuesday today, the 2nd of October. Good to have you with us, as always. Hey, so you remember toxic assets? I know, how could you forget, right? The root cause, really, of the whole financial crisis. The lousy mortgages bundled into even lousier bonds that big banks sold off seemingly willy-nilly until the whole thing went bust. We now have, though, the first big government case filed against one of the banks that went bust. A joint working group that President Obama set up earlier this year has filed suit against J.P. Morgan Chase, which now owns Bear Stearns, the bank that went bust. The suit accuses Bear of selling bonds, mortgage-backed securities, remember, that were backed by mortgages that Bear knew weren't going to pay off. Eric Schneiderman is the attorney general of the state of New York. He is also the co-chairman of that state federal task force I mentioned, and he is the one who filed the suit last night. Mr. Schneiderman, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
This is the first major case that's been filed in relation to one of the big companies that went under in the financial crisis, Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. I have to ask, with all respect, where you been, sir? We're 4.5 years on now.
Would I have liked for things to have gone faster? I'm an impatient guy. I'm from Manhattan. But we bring cases when they're ready, and you will see more cases in the weeks and months ahead.
Still, though, why you? Why not the federal government?
This particular case we brought under the Martin Act, which is our New York State securities law. But believe me, this is brought very much as a part of a team effort. There were folks in U.S. attorneys' offices around the country who helped us do interviews. So this is a collective effort.
As you know, Bear Stearns was acquired by J.P. Morgan Chase because Henry Paulson, then the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, his successor, and Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed, all but begged Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, to do this and bail him out. Is J.P. Morgan Chase now being punished for something the government encouraged?
No. I think that all we're doing is sending the message that there's one set of rules for everyone. It would send a terrible message if we said this flamboyant fraud, this gross misconduct and misleading investors by a firm that was really at the top of this market, if we let them go for this kind of gross misconduct just because of the chain of title and who happened to purchase them, that would send a terrible message. I think, if anything, the American people think there weren't enough strings put on the bailouts of the banks. They bought Bear Stearns with a $29 billion taxpayer-backed loan. So I think folks really are looking to see accountability. And I get more complaints coming the other way, quite frankly.
If I invested in one of these securities that Bear Stearns sold, or if I – and lost money, lots of money – or if I got trapped into a fraudulent mortgage that Bear Stearns was packaging in here, how does this make me feel better? What does it do?
Well, when there is a recovery, either after trial or through a settlement – and the investors get money, it will make them feel somewhat better. Is this going to get us all the way back to where we were pre-crash? No, we're never going to get back to the point before these folks that we're suing and others created an unprecedented bubble in the American housing market, resulting in an unprecedented crash in the American economy. we're never getting back the $7.4 trillion of home equity that was lost to the American people. We will get some recovery. We will get some sense of justice. But most important, the next time around, you can't get away with things just because you're big or influential or powerful. It's very important to get out the truth about everything that happened in the last crash so we can have a good working set of rules that are good for the industry and good for investors going forward.
Why was this filed, Mr. Schneiderman, as a civil complaint and not a criminal complaint? Is it just because the burden of proof is easier on you guys?
Well, the burden of proof is different. There are a lot of different reasons, but this is the first case of the working group, not the last case, and this particular complaint is a civil complaint.
Do you believe there was criminal activity here?
I don't want to comment on that. As I say, I'm one of a group of prosecutors who are still investigating these.
Well, I ask because the question, of course, is why nobody's gone to jail yet.
Well, we're still in the middle of an investigation, and I really don't want to comment. This case is, I think, probably the most significant case that's been brought by a public entity thus far. And my colleagues in the working group and I are continuing to pursue other matters, and I think it will be sooner rather than later that you'll see additional actions.
All right. Eric Schneiderman is the Attorney General of the State of New York talking about his complaint against J.P. Morgan from late last night. Mr. Schneiderman, thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you.
I asked Mr. Schneiderman, as you heard, about J.P. Morgan buying Bear Stearns at the behest of the federal government. One wonders if Jamie Dimon regrets that purchase right about now. From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more on paying for the misdeeds of companies past.
In March of 2008, Bear Stearns was collapsing. In stepped J.P. Morgan. It snapped up the faltering Bear Stearns, took some early losses, and then looked like it was in the clear. Until now.
It's a little bit like buying a dog. You get the dog, but you get the fleas with it.
James Cox is a law professor at Duke University. He expects we'll start seeing more government cases like this one.
This is the most visible, broad-based prosecution by a public agency of investment banks. It resonates with what the public's general attitude is.
Which is hungry for someone to be held accountable for the financial crisis, says Dartmouth Business School professor Matt Slaughter.
There still in America is this pervasive sense of unfairness and lack of responsibility in the wake of the world financial crisis.
J.P. Morgan says it will contest the allegations. But is it fair that J.P. Morgan take the hit for the alleged sins of a company it bought? John Coffey is a law professor at Columbia University. He says that risk was baked into the deal, and it was a deal. J.P. Morgan paid about $1.5 billion for Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns' building alone was worth almost that.
The government also provided very attractive financing to J.P. Morgan. So there's the bitter and the sweet, and you can't separate the two.
J.P. Morgan may find itself in the same boat as Bank of America. B of A has paid out billions of dollars to settle lawsuits around alleged wrongdoing by two troubled companies it bought, Countrywide and Merrill Lynch. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Traders had a mixed message kind of day today. Two indices up, one down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Out on the campaign trail, we've heard both candidates talking about energy independence. It's a safe bet we're going to hear that phrase tomorrow in the first presidential debate. But really, energy independence, what exactly does it mean and what doesn't it mean? And moreover, how does any of that square with the realities of the energy markets? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has this declaration.
When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary to go on TV and proclaim freedom from foreign oil, energy pros start throwing stuff.
It's like listening to fingernails on a chalkboard because you know better than this.
Yeah, I roll my eyes. It's kind of meaningless because, honestly, the U.S. actually does not use that much Middle Eastern oil.
Well, we've had this mythology of energy independence for a while.
You get the picture. First, let's talk about physical supply of oil, the idea we have to drill our own or get it from nearby friends. That mattered in the energy crisis of the 70s. Industry veteran Michael Herberg, now at the National Bureau for Asian Research, he remembers. He could only pump back then based on his license plate number.
We could fuel up on Friday coming over, and we could fuel up on Sunday going back, but not on Saturday. Odd even gas days and gas lines of 30 or 40 cars, running out of gas while they're in line, pushing their vehicles to the pump.
Back then, the oil markets were rigid. It's a little bit like your cable TV company. You're locked into a seller long term. And if something goes wrong, you're stuck. Today, we can always buy oil from somewhere. If you pay a high enough price, whistle and it'll come. Chevron veteran Ed Chow now thinks at a tank called the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
You can have a tanker that starts from the Persian Gulf, destined for Rotterdam, and discover that the higher market's in Singapore, and it will go to Singapore instead in mid-voyage.
Domestic supply matters less in today's global market of buyers and sellers. The good news is we can all get the oil. The bad news? We all pay the same basic price. So even if a country becomes totally self-sufficient, we all get nailed if there's a world shock. Chow recalls when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf.
Norwegian gasoline prices went up. Norway is an oil and gas exporter. Now, why should refinery closings in the United States affect them? Well, it did.
So to escape volatility, the trick to independence is not to get off foreign oil, but to get off oil, period. Still, there are other big benefits to producing more domestic oil. And the Americans are. In North Dakota, in the Gulf, in Texas, thanks to new technology and high prices. Ed Morris at Citigroup figures North America could be the next Middle East by 2020.
It's what we call reserve to production ratio, the number of years of production that we have. We were at around 20 years 5 years ago. We're now at 120 years.
Morse may be the most bullish of the bulls. He thinks we can cut our oil imports down to zero.
And if we eliminate our import bill for oil, we're going to basically eliminate the deficit.
Perhaps. But say our oil imports don't go all the way down to zero, but they shrink by half. If and when prices spike, as they inevitably do, more of the oil producers making money would be Americans. Again, Michael Herberg.
A lot of that wealth will stay in the U.S.
So, yes, there could be big economic benefits to more self-sufficiency. But in a global market, free at last from price volatility and shocks, or energy indip, you know, I better not say it again. Makes these guys crazy. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow night, by the way, we're going to be live tweeting that first debate I mentioned. It's going to be mostly the economy and domestic affairs. You can watch it on our website, marketplace.org, and you can join us there as well. Let's say you need a nice pair of khakis or a well-fitting shirt, and you're okay spending a little bit of money on it. If you're a certain kind of shopper, you might wind up at Banana Republic, now known as the high-end retail brand of Gap. But back in the day, high-end was the furthest thing from the minds of the two people who founded Banana Republic, Mel and Patricia Ziegler. They have written the story of that company's very early days, the earliest days, in fact, in a book called Wild Company. Mel, Patricia, it's good to have you both here.
Oh, thanks, Kai.
Nice to be
here.
Good to
be here.
So, Mel, let me ask you this. This entire adventure, I think you could fairly call it, based on my read of this book, started with a jacket, right? It was a British Burmese
yes.
jacket. Tell me about that coat.
It was a British Burma jacket. Burma. I found the jacket at a disposal store in Sydney.
Mel got so many compliments on this jacket that gave us the idea to start a business.
Was there a business plan, Patricia? Because my sense of this book is, yeah, no, not really.
No. Our business plan was to find more clothes like this and sell them. That was it.
Okay.
Our business plan was to never work for anybody else again.
That was the mission, yes.
You had what, like $1,000, right?
$1,500. That was the total investment. That's all we had. And an American Express card.
There came a time when you guys realized that you had a finite supply of stuff. I mean, there are only so many Army-Navy surplus stores in the world that you can go shopping in. How and when did you decide you were going to start doing your own stuff, Patricia?
Well, we started remanufacturing the surplus at the beginning, and we couldn't keep that up. It was obvious that we had to do our own clothing.
And you designed and then you outsourced and the whole deal? I mean, you had it made and everything.
Well, yeah, draw it up, got a team together. We'd make the patterns, the first prototypes. We traveled all over England looking for the original factories that made these for the British Empire.
Oh, is that right? Did you find them, really?
Oh, yeah.
We did. We found several and brought people back to work.
We tried to make them to the same quality that the surplus was. The government spared nothing to make this clothing, and it set the standard to create authentic travel and safari clothing, which is what the company became at that point.
Just in the interest of time, I think we have to fast forward a little bit. But you set up a retail store, you get some good publicity, things go well, you get a catalog operation, all kinds of things. And then this guy comes knocking on your door, and his name is Donald Fisher, and he runs this company called The Gap, Mel, right? And he says...
He says, I want to buy your company. And we said, great. And at the end of 4 months, he says, you know, I can't buy your company unless the two of you stay. And I say, well, we weren't looking for jobs. He said, no, you can totally autonomous. You can run the company, do whatever you want. As long as it's profitable, I'll finance anything you want to do.
I'll give you total creative control, he said.
And for you guys, actually, just to break in for a minute, creative control is no small thing because you had a tradition of wacky store displays and creative marketing and all this stuff. And you were not the standard button-down Gap kind of person, right? How do you feel now that Banana Republic has become mainstream and it's high-end, you know, nice clothes and all, but it's stuff you can find in a whole lot of different places?
Well, I had to say that when you give your baby up for adoption, you can't really quibble with how it's raised.
Mel?
Well, I mean, honestly, don't like it. I wish they had changed the name. It has nothing to do with what the original company was all about. But that's the way it goes in American business.
Do you wish you'd kept it, either one of you?
No, we never look back. Life has been very good to us.
Last thing before I let you go. Do you guys ever stop in or shop at a Banana Republic?
No, we have plenty of clothes. We made them to last a lifetime.
We shop in our own closet.
Mel and Patricia Ziegler. Their book is called Wild Company, The Untold Story of Banana Republic, which is the company they founded. Thanks you guys very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, Barry Diller makes the move to books.
I've always been interested in businesses in transition. And if ever there was a business in transition, it is publishing.
The chairman of IAC. But first, let's do the numbers. A mix of worries today, a melange, you might say, made for an up-and-down day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials slipped 0.2%, 32 points, 13,482 at the bell for the blue chips. The NASDAQ picked up 0.2%, 6 points, 3120 is the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 also ended positive, up nearly 0.1%, 1.1445. Concerned about Spain and quarterly earnings, financial firms couldn't quite make up their minds. Bank of America tossed off a 3%. J.P. Morgan Chase gave up a 0.1%, but Citigroup gained 0.5%. Auto sales numbers drove car makers in both directions. General Motors advanced 2.5% after reporting growth in September in sales, but Ford reversed nearly 1.5%. Its sales were flat. Bonds held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note remained at 1.62%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Carbonite, providing small businesses with automatic and continual cloud backup, plus anytime, anywhere access. Learn more at Carbonite.com. And by Vanderbilt University Medical Center, using a patient's DNA to customize cholesterol therapy at VanderbiltHealth.com, the promise of discovery. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama and the First Lady were married 20 years ago in Chicago. Break out the hors d'oeuvres. I know some of you are throwing presidential debate watching parties. Would you like some guacamole to go with that partisan bickering? And happy birthday, Gwen Stefani. Singer-songwriter will be 43. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hey, so anybody out there remember Datsun, what Nissan used to be called in this country before it was Nissan? Well, Nissan said today it's going to revive its old and affordable brand that dates to the 1950s. But this time, they're going to make it really affordable. They're talking as low as $3,000 per car. Not for here, of course. It's for developing countries. India, for instance. So what kind of car can you get for $3,000? Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that story.
Mention the idea of a $3,000 car, and most people think it's a joke. Lawnmowers on steroids, somebody told me. But auto analyst Michelle Krebs says automakers like Nissan aren't laughing.
This kind of vehicle is not a joke among the automakers because they know that the emerging markets is where their future audience is.
But to get a car's price tag down to $3,000, what do designers have to toss out first?
Well, okay, just off the top of my head.
Bernard Swicky is with the Center for Automotive Research.
Airbags, anti-lock brakes, electronic stability control, certainly a degree of emissions control.
Not to mention oomph, count on a tiny engine, manual transmission, lots of plastic, and it's a hatchback.
And it may be that the hatch wouldn't even open.
That's Gary Vasilash, editor-in-chief of Automotive Design and Production. We caught him on his cell phone, sitting in the cute new Toyota Scion IQ. He's test-driving the $16,000 car, luxury compared to no-frills mini cars like the Tata Nano. Toyota chopped the price on the Scion IQ in part by chopping down the back seat.
I guess if you were driving with the Keebler Elves, you could put three of them in the back.
But when Nissan comes out with that ultra-cheap Datsun for India and China, just remember, they'll market it to people now driving three-wheeled contraptions, motorcycles, and even scooters. In their case, four wheels and a motor might not sound so bad. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
If you go online looking for, say, restaurant recommendations, you might well go to Urban Spoon. If you're looking for love, you might wind up at Match.com. If you did either of those, you'd be going to sites owned by a company called IAC, which is run by a guy named Barry Diller, who from his earliest days in a mailroom in Hollywood has seen the future and been able to make money from it. In the movies, at the Fox Network before it was a network, online, and now he hopes in publishing. It's a new company called Brightline, ebooks to start and then printed ones down the road. So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Barry Diller, the chairman of IAC. Mr. Diller, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What is it about this moment in the publishing business that made you say that it's ripe for an opportunity for you with Brightline?
I think publishing is going to go through, has been going through, but in the next 5 years, 10 years at the most, is going to go through more transition than it's had in the last 100 years. Given that there are six big publishing houses that dominate the market who have been in business give or take 100 years. And I think that's an opportunity. I've always been interested in businesses in transition. And if ever there was a business in transition, it is publishing.
Well, just to pick up on that, this is kind of a theme for you, right? This ability you seem to have to grab things that are disruptive and shake them up. Is that what you look for, a chance to really mix people up and make them rethink things?
Yes. When we started Fox Broadcasting, and you know, this was in a primarily a three-network universe.
Oh, yeah, back in the day, right?
Cable was going but wasn't really doing original programming. And so we said, well, we think there should be a fourth alternative. Now there's 78 alternatives. But then it was, well, you must be crazy. You know, that'll never work. Look, you balance doing things against risk. It's not that I'm ever particularly confident. What I am is willing to find out.
Was there a moment when you realized that entertainment had to change in order to thrive and make it?
What happened, personally, just to me, I had been in the movie business and television businesses for 20-plus years at senior positions. And I felt I was repeating myself. I felt that there was no longer a great thrill in opening a movie. And I thought, what does the world tell me? And so I drove around for 6 or 8 months and found my way serendipitously to QVC in Western Pennsylvania and said, oh, my God, screens for me have been about narrative, telling stories. Here's a screen being used to not only tell about goods, but sell them directly to consumers. I had such a strong instinct that it was the beginning of change, and I was just lucky because 3 years later, along came the internet.
You are on the record as vocally opposing media consolidation, that you think it's bad for a bunch of big companies to own everything that we hear, see, and touch and do. Yet you do seem to be acquiring and owning a whole bunch of what we see, hear, and do, certainly online anyway.
Not as much as the big media companies, the big conglomerated media companies.
You don't call yourself a conglomerate and a media company all in one?
I call us a conglomerate, absolutely. And yes, we are a media company. What I was referring to is that the four major film producers and the four major television production entities are all owned by four people. I think there's tremendous diversity now, but I still think the concentration is, I don't say it's un-American or it's antisocial. I think it's inefficient.
Purely from a business sense. Doesn't make a business sense.
I think one of the reasons movies kind of stink is because they're now so low on the totem pole of greater corporate interests. It used to be, you know, when I came to Fox, Fox was almost totally, it had about 20% of its revenue, maybe 20% of its revenue came from television, 80% came from film. Out of that, look what Fox has become. Multiple cable networks.
Yeah.
International distribution all over the world. Controlling interest in B-Sky-B. I mean, you know, in other words, it's a multi-diversified company.
This is going to sound like a kind of a sideways question to a guy who is in business, obviously, as everybody is, to make a lot of money. But how do you feel, getting back to our conversation about disruption, how do you feel about losing money on the way to a successful disruption? I ask because of your investment in the Daily Beast and Newsweek, which is, you know, the fading Newsweekly and all that.
Oh, yes, it is. First of all, I really do believe that it is it is investment and not losses. You should invest as little as you can to make go what you want to go. But I think you have to have a high tolerance for unproven investment. Now, at a certain point, as we've done in some things, where we've said, well, we've invested $90 million in this, and it hasn't worked out for us. Sell it. Write it off. Go on to the next thing.
Write it off and don't look back.
Absolutely.
Barry Diller, he is the chairman and senior executive at IAC. Mr. Diller, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing travel insurance and assistance to over 9 million Americans through its affiliated companies in the U.S., AllianzUSA.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the NFL refs have made a deal with the league, as you know, but the NHL lockout continues. If you're missing your hockey fix, though, ESPN has signed a deal to show hockey. From Russia, the debut is tomorrow. You can check it out if you like. Dynamo Moscow plays Akbar Kazan. I think that's how you pronounce it. If it's not, you know, write to me, let me know. Also, tomorrow night, the presidential debate, mostly the economy and domestic affairs. If you want somebody to watch it with, come our way. We'll be streaming it live, marketplace.org. I'll be live tweeting at Kai Rizdahl is how you find me there. And we'll be answering any questions you have about the whole smash as well. So join us if you like. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace, the radio show from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Haas and Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.